Welcome to the Paramedia Podcast with Luke and the Rocket.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Mero Media Podcast. I'm your host today, Mukunda Raghavan, and I am joined by Dr. Khalil Andani, who is a professor of religious studies, particularly Islamic studies. Professor Andani is, I've been following him for actually for a very long time. He is one of the, I would say, one of the strongest intellectually honest interlocutors I have seen online and engagement with various other traditions. He's not trying to win debates. He's not trying to win. He's trying to get to the truth. And I really appreciate that more so than, you know, I've been on a few shows with the Dawah Wise people, and it's more contentious. And I feel like there's people like Dr. Andani, there's Dr. Hashimi, there's a few other doctors, professors that engage very, very well in the public setting. And you know, to have him on the show is a great privilege for me. And we've been trying to do it for a while. And I think it'll be a great sense of information and knowledge for you guys. So Dr. Andani, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to finally be here. I know we've been trying to schedule this for I don't know if it's been months.
Yes.
But I'm glad that we could do it. And I mean, for those who don't know, Mukunda guest spoke in one of my classes about a month ago. I really owed him.
You don't owe me anything. That's
now,
that's
now
always
I'm
good
here.
Stuff.
So now we can do it.
Yeah. So Dr. Andani, can you tell us a little bit about your background, like where you grew up and kind of like your tradition and how you got to studying Islam and making this kind of like the center of your engagement?
Sure. So I grew up in a Ismaili Muslim family in Canada, and my family is South Asian. And as many South Asian men and women who grow up as sort of, you know, in immigrant families, my household was one of a lot of intellectual curiosity. My parents read a lot of books, and we would have discussions about politics and religion all the time from a young age. So, you know, we were always encouraged to learn about our history. Mm-hmm. And to ask questions about beliefs and things like this. So I developed an intellectual curiosity in the study of religion when I was quite young, probably when I was like 6 or 7 years old. I used to read like children level books on world religions. So that was my interest from a very young age. But as many South Asian people know, I was told by my parents and uncles and aunts that, you know, when you grow up, you have to be a doctor, an engineer, yeah, a lawyer, a banker, an accountant. And, you know, you're given options and it's all in the professions. So I picked accountant because I was good at math and my dad was a qualified CA where he was from. So that's what I picked, and I fall. I went by the book. I got good grades. Went to the University of Waterloo. Did a bachelor's of math. I did a master's of accounting. I worked for KPMG, the accounting firm, for many years in Toronto. I was living downtown, but I always had this other interest in the study of religion, philosophy, the history of Islam, and I would always read books on that.
Right.
Throughout my education, right? Even when I'm in university. And sometimes I would find that instead of studying for the calculus exam, I'm reading about metaphysics instead. And then when I was going to work as a CPA in Canada, I'm on taking a long train ride, hour train ride to downtown. I was more interested in reading about, you know, comparative studies of Hinduism and Islam instead of accounting.
Right.
So I, after some soul searching, I decided to change careers. And because I had a strong interest in Islamic studies, it's very hard academically to say you specialize in two or three religions.
Right.
I was told you should focus on one. So because I already had an interest in the study of Islam academically, I knew most of the literature, that's what I aimed to go into. So in 2011, I quit my accounting job. I moved back in with my parents at the age of, you know, in my late 20s. And I started learning Arabic with Shabir Ali, who many people know. He was my Arabic teacher at the University of Toronto. And then I applied for grad schools to do a master's degree. That's the first step. And I got rejected everywhere except Harvard Divinity School.
That's so funny.
Yeah. But they're known for that. I actually found out that Harvard Divinity School and American schools tend to look at candidates like me who don't have a background but a strong interest. They go easier on us because they're, you know, some of these programs exist to transition people like myself. So I went to Harvard Divinity School. I did a master's in Islamic studies there. Got to do a little bit of comparative work with, you know, South Asian traditions and Christianity. The faculty at Harvard are the best. And then I reapplied to Harvard to do a PhD, which started in 2014. And at the end of 2019, I defended my PhD. So my focus is on the academic study of Islam, in specific, the intellectual history of Islam. So the history of ideas, right? And that includes studying how belief, practice, and worldviews evolve across communities, across time and space. And you're not just studying ideas, you're studying like the sociological factors and the political factors that give rise to certain ideas. And that Harvard education, PhD in Islamic studies, is quite all-encompassing. Mm-hmm. So I had to learn Arabic and Persian in order to read and translate those texts. And my advisor, I don't know if you know about him, Dr. Professor Ali Asani, mm-hmm. he's a specialist in Islam and South Asia. And he really sort of pushed me and said, you can't just learn about Islam in Iran and the Levant. You have to learn about Islam in India and Pakistan. So that was part of my education as well. So now I'm an assistant professor of religion at Augustana College. And as many people may not know, but you may do your whole degree in Islamic studies, but when you're faculty, when you're a professor, you have to teach about multiple religions.
Right.
And a lot of people don't like that, but I love it. Mm-hmm. So I teach a world religion class where we do seven religions. I'm teaching a comparative mysticism class where we compare Hindu, Muslim, and Christian mystical philosophers.
Very interesting.
I teach one class on Islam as well. So that's what I'm doing. So at a teaching level, I do comparative religion, but at a research level, I stick to Islamic intellectual history.
That's very interesting. So what part of South Asia is your family from?
So my family, like i.e. my parents, are from East Africa.
Okay.
And they're part of that South Asian diaspora that settled in Africa, you know, in the late 19th century and the early 20th century. But ethnically, I guess we would be originally from Gujarat, although I don't really have the family history. And I am told that there is some Iranian mixed in there somewhere, but I don't have the records.
Do you guys speak Gujarati at home or no?
We grew up hearing a lot of Kutchi. I can understand Kutchi, but I can't speak it.
But you know, it is interesting because I before we're jumped on, we talked about how, you know, I growing up, especially in college, I met a lot of Muslims from different backgrounds, but I met quite a few, especially at UC Irvine, that were Ismaili, right? And that were Gujarati Ismaili. And so they spoke Gujarati at home. And that to me was actually very, very interesting when I started to learn about the Ismaili tradition and how they viewed, you know, their larger intellectual metaphysical world. I mean, we'll get into that, but, you know, I think there's just so much diversity that exists also within Islam that people don't get enough access to. But the problem also, you know, is in some sense that there's a hardcore section of certain groups of Islam that would consider Ismailis, Ahmadis, and other traditions to be non-Muslims for whatever purpose. So in your studies, when you started studying, I mean, obviously, like, I think your professors hit the nail on the head about studying South Asia, especially because the bulk of the Islamic population of the world is sitting out of India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. But what would you say is like the real distinctive part about the tradition within, particularly Ismaili tradition, that makes it connected to South Asia.
Sure. So today, Ismailis are found in about, 35 different countries. Mm-hmm. There's an Ismaili diaspora, and Ismaili Muslims come from various ethnicities. The history of the Ismailis spans, several regions. So the origins of what we call the Ismaili movement within Islam, the origins, of course, are in Arabia, mm-hmm. In the Hijaz, because the Ismailis are a group of Shia Muslims who believe that the spiritual authority and the spiritual knowledge and the spiritual powers of the Holy Prophet Muhammad were bequeathed by the Prophet to his family members, mm-hmm. namely his cousin Ali ibn Abi Talib. So Shia Muslims in general and Ismailis in particular recognize Ali as the supreme leader or guide of the believers, mm-hmm. referred to as the Imam. And the Imam, of course, doesn't bring a new scripture like the Prophet did. He doesn't bring more Quranic verses or another scripture, but the Imam is seen as the infallible, divinely guided interpreter of Islam.
Okay.
Right. So Ali is the first of these Imams. And then that position passes on to one of Ali's sons, whom he would have appointed. So the position of Imam is inherited.
Got it.
But it's an appointment, right? It's not just the firstborn gets it or this mm-hmm. sort of thing. So what distinguishes the Ismailis from other groups is the Ismailis are followers of a particular lineage of these Imams from Ali.
Okay.
And that lineage of Imams initially lived in Arabia, right? So the earliest Ismailis are Arabs. And many of them are also in Iraq, because mm-hmm. the Imams would visit Iraq sometimes and so on. The later period, the Ismaili Imams are in Syria. We have Syrian Ismailis. Then later they moved to Egypt, so we had Egyptian Ismailis. For the longest period, the Ismaili Imams lived in Persia.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of Persian Ismailis. And then, of course, there are Ismaili missionary scholars going around the world inviting people to believe and accept the Ismaili Imam. So we have Ismaili communities in Central Asia, in Tajikistan, in Afghanistan, in places like that. And part of the regions where the Ismaili mission was active for many centuries was South Asia.
Right.
So now we have Ismaili communities that formed in South Asia as early as the 900s. So today we have many Ismaili communities. Most of the Ismailis who first settled in the Western world, who you probably met, that of course includes me, most of us are from South Asia, but now we have Afghan Ismailis and Tajik Ismailis. We have Syrian Ismailis. Many have come to Europe and North America through various programs, sometimes as refugees because of the wars that are going on. So it's a multi-ethnic community of faith today.
So on that note, can we just briefly touch upon the difference between Shia Sunni and then maybe difference between Sunni Ismaili? I mean, not Sunni Ismaili, Shia Ismaili, right? Because there might be differences between these.
Sure. Groups. Yeah. So I'm gonna share my screen. I'm gonna put a little visual up here. So this diagram here is an attempt to summarize, like really summarize,
right,
the difference between Sunni and Shia and the difference within the Shia between the Ismaili branch and the Twelver branch. So at the top here, you can see the Prophet Muhammad. He dies in 632.
Mm-hmm.
Prophet Muhammad was seen as a messenger of God, but simultaneously he was the representative of God for his community, right? So all religious, spiritual, political, moral guidance came from the Prophet. Like whether that's part of the actual Quran or whether it's in his own words,
mm-hmm.
right? The Prophet was the fountainhead of divine guidance. He died in 632. At that time, there is a dispute over, is there someone who succeeds the prophet? And in what sense do they succeed him? And there were a lot of positions that were presented early on. There were debates, arguments, there was violence, you know, and so on. In summary, though, here's what ended up happening. So over 500 years, a perspective evolved, which we today call Sunni.
Okay.
So it took 500 years for this to come together. It was not there like on day one.
Okay.
So through the 500 years, after much contestation and debate and negotiation, the group known as the Sunnis came to believe that after Prophet Muhammad, God has not appointed someone to succeed him. So the Muslim community can decide through various processes who succeeds him. And the will of the Muslim community, it was claimed, is that the political authority of Muhammad will go to the caliphate. Okay. The bearer of that office is known as the caliph.
Mm-hmm.
The religious authority of Muhammad, the authority to interpret Islam on a daily basis, to give rulings on this is how you practice and this is allowed, this is not allowed, rulings about, you know, what are the orthodox beliefs. So that religious authority, the Sunnis decided, lay in the hands of their scholars, mm-hmm. the ulama. And finally, the mystical authority of the prophet for those Sunnis who want to go deeper in their religion, right? Who want to experience God and purify themselves. So the spiritual authority to oversee that search, that is believed to be among the group known as the Sufi sheikhs, okay? The leaders of the Sufi orders.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how the Sunnis see it.
Okay.
And that took 500 years at least. So that's Sunnis. Today, the Sunnis are the majority, okay? But back in the day, this was not the case because this doctrine had not even been consolidated, right?
Okay.
On the other hand, the Shi'i Muslims, who as a group exist much earlier than the Sunnis, okay? So the Shia as a group exist within 100 years of the death of the prophet. This has been confirmed by historical research. Like we have the evidence. So the Shia group said that the direct divine revelation will end with the prophet, but divine inspiration, divine guidance must continue because humans always require divine guidance to find the right way to God.
Sure.
So therefore, somebody must have succeeded the prophet to be the source of divine guidance, to tell people an infallible understanding of God's law, correct belief, correct practice, and so on. So the Shia believed that the prophet had actually appointed Ali, his cousin and son-in-law, to be the first divinely guided leader.
Okay.
So they followed Ali. And this was a minority group, but an important group. When Ali died, most of the Shia believed that his two sons, who are the grandsons of Prophet Muhammad, that his two sons, Hassan and Hussein, took over that leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Then when Hussein dies, they follow the next son. And then they follow the next son. So that's the early Shia.
Okay.
And each imam, each divinely guided leader, appoints the next one.
Okay.
However,
so on this note, would the Shia say that the imams have all three authority, political, religious, and spiritual, or they would just have one or two? Or okay,
no, the Shia would say that the imam rightfully is the holder of all three, political, religious, and spiritual authority. But in actual history, the political authority was exercised by these dynasties of caliphs, right, who had armies to actually impose their political will. So for most of history, the Shia imams never could exercise political authority, although it is believed that they have a moral right to that, even if they're prevented from exercising it.
Understood.
Then with the Imam Jafar Sadiq, so this is, you know, the fifth generation descendant of Ali and Prophet Muhammad now. So Imam Jafar Sadiq passes away in the year 765, and we have a split, okay, the Shia split now. They disagree who did Imam Jafar appoint to be the imam after him, right? Who is the divinely guided, infallible imam after Imam Jafar?
Got it.
So you have this schism within the Shia community. And there were actually many, many other candidates, but these are the two main groups that have survived to this day. So one group said that Imam Jafar's successor is his younger son, Musa, over here.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the future imams will be the descendants of Musa. So they'll follow Musa, his son. And that group eventually, by the year, 874, that group stops the lineage of imams at the 12th imam. And that's because the 12th imam, in their belief, disappeared as a young boy. His father died. He could not be found. And then some people claim that there was a young boy who was the successor, and he has disappeared. And the belief of the 12er Shia, they're called 12er because they believe in 12 imams, they believe that this imam has been hidden by God. He is in what you call an occultation.
Okay.
And he has been in occultation since the year 874 AD. So they continue to believe that this person is alive. He's on earth.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knows who he is, what he looks like. No one knows his identity, but he's here. And they await his messianic return.
And he's the Mahdi, right?
He's the Mahdi, correct.
Okay.
So that's the 12ers. Today, they are the majority of Shia Muslims. There's about 300 million of them.
Okay.
They were not always the majority, though, okay? If we look at history, they're the majority today, mainly because of certain political dynasties that promoted this form of Shia.
And that's where the Iran tends to be the 12ers, correct? Okay.
Correct. Yeah. So Iran today is majority 12er. And a big reason for that is because the Safavid dynasty that ruled Persia, they made 12erism the state religion.
Got it.
So that's one Shia. And when you hear the word Shia today in the news, often they're talking about 12ers.
Okay.
Now, the other group is the Ismailis. And the Ismailis differ from the 12ers because the Ismailis believe that the imam after Imam Jafar, the rightful successor, was his elder son, Ismail. And you can see the name connection.
Oh, right.
Right? So they follow Ismail as the imam. And there is good historical evidence that Imam Jafar actually appointed Ismail. This is something that various sources attest to, including the opinion of historical academics. So they follow Ismail, then they follow the son of Ismail as the next imam, and then they follow that lineage.
Got it.
So this is a different lineage of imams. And eventually the Ismailis also will split over a very similar issue of the succession of a particular imam who, which son is the right one.
Right.
So the Ismailis will split into two major groups. One group is known as the Boras. Maybe you're familiar with them because they are in South Asia, right?
Yeah.
And without going into details, the imams of the Boras also went into hiding around the year 1130. The imams of the Boras go into hiding. Okay. So they don't have a visible imam, but they follow a leader called the Dai Mutlak, who's seen as like the deputy of their hidden imams.
Okay.
All right, so Sayyidina Mufaddal Saifuddin, he's a major figure like in India today. The headquarters of the Boras is in India today.
Okay.
The Nizari group, right, they follow a lineage of imams to the present day that are visible, right, that are accessible. And the current imam of the Nizari Ismailis is Shah Karim al-Husseini, known publicly as Aga Khan.
Okay.
He's also, of course, very well known, right? He is the founder of the Aga Khan Development Network. He visits the developing world all the time. He has various humanitarian projects in India, in Pakistan, in Bangladesh, right? So he's very well known in the East, right?
Okay.
And he is the imam of the Nizari Ismailis. So the guidance of the Aga Khan is seen as divinely inspired and infallible by the Nizari Ismailis. For Nizari Ismailis, the Aga Khan is the interpreter, the rightful interpreter of Islam. So all questions about how to practice Islam, orthopraxy, orthodoxy, morals, ethics, even, you know, the right way to navigate oneself on political issues, perhaps, all these issues, quality of life, the Aga Khan is the leader and the guide for the Nizari Ismaili. So today, when somebody says they're Ismaili, almost 100% of the time, they are Nizari Ismaili, and they are followers of the Aga Khan. And he's the 49th Imam, so he's the direct descendant of Ali, first Imam, right? In an unbroken lineage. So that's basically the map.
Would the Boras say they're Boras and not Ismaili? Is that how that works?
Today, yeah. Okay. So today, the Boras call themselves Boras, and I think that comes from the word Bora, from a particular Indian vernacular.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So on this point, both Shias and Sunnis, they share the same Quran, right? The Quran's not different for them. Like, is that like 100% the same for both, or is there?
Yes. Okay. So the text of the Quran as we have it today,
okay, right?
If you pick up any Quran, there's Arabic text in there. So fundamentally, that Arabic text was written on paper in the form of a book around the year 650.
Okay,
it's about 20 years after Muhammad's death.
Right.
In the time of Prophet Muhammad, of course, the Quran was an oral phenomenon, and primarily it still is an oral phenomenon, just like the Vedas are primarily an oral phenomenon, right? So the Quran means recitation in Arabic. So it's really an oral text, but it was written down quite early for practical reasons.
Okay.
And since that time, every copy of the Quran that we have, except one, but every copy of the Quran that we have is just a copy of this Quran written in the year 650 by the Caliph Uthman. He's
right.
The third Caliph by Sunni. So he made a committee. They compiled the Quran. And today, that's the only Quran that all Muslim communities use.
So it's not like the biblical transition where you find, not translations, but the passage of manuscripts, we find like errors in different versions of the Bible, right? So does the Quran have that too?
Okay, so you have, in Arabic, there are different layers to a text. So the first layer is what we call the skeletal text, like the consonantal text in Arabic. Apart from one, they have found one non-Uthmanic copy, which we don't have to get into. Apart from one example, all Qurans have the same consonantal text.
Okay.
But when you vocalize that text, right, when you read it aloud, you add vowels in.
Right.
Right. And most people know the vowels because the Quran has been memorized. But there are different ways to vocalize that same text. So in the Sunni tradition, there are, I think, 10 distinct vocalizations. Okay. So for example, what that means is that you'll have slight differences in words among these 10 vocalizations.
Right.
The meaning of it is often not affected.
Okay.
But specific words, it's like, you know, the vowel is an ah sound instead of an oo sound on a certain.
But that doesn't change the meaning of the word?
No. I don't know of any case where it's a fundamental change in meaning.
Right.
Especially on theology or law. And again, among those 10 vocalizations, it's been estimated by modern scholars that it's like less than 5% or less than 3% of the text is actually different. So most vocalizations among the 10 are the same. Right, it's only about like 3 to 5% of vocalized words that are different, and that doesn't mean the meaning is even different. The meaning is even less variable than that. Those are known as the qira'at.
Okay,
the qira'at. The Shia only use one of these qira'at anyway.
Okay.
But Sunnis recognize 10.
Interesting.
So that's basically what you have. And it's not, now, manuscript errors are a different thing. I mean, you can find errors in any manuscript
because
scribes make mistakes and so on. So manuscript errors are present in anything, right? But we know, by we, I mean the scholarly community. The scholarly community basically knows what the original compiled Quranic text is.
Got it. So on that, so you guys have the same Quran. How about hadiths? Would your hadiths be similar, or are they different? Or
no? So the hadith, so the Shia communities and Sunni communities share different. I'll rephrase: Sunni communities and Shi'i communities have completely different hadith books. The reason, of course, is that hadith, for the first 200 years of Islam, hadith were transmitted orally.
Right.
And because they were transmitted orally, we have very little material evidence of what that transmission even looks like, right? Then around, it's in the 800s that paper becomes more available.
Right.
And Muslim scholars start writing hadith down around the 800s. Hadith are written down and circulated also to fulfill a practical issue. With the death of the prophet, the Quranic text is not enough to answer all the fundamental questions about practice and belief. The Quran on many issues doesn't tell you much. It mentions prayer. It doesn't tell you how to pray.
Right.
It mentions fasting in Ramadan, but all the what if questions, it doesn't really get into. This is the case for most Islamic practice. It's not detailed in the Quran. Presumably, the prophet, when he was alive, he clarified all of those matters, right? Now, when the prophet has died physically, there's a bit of a void now. So Shia communities, they originally didn't need hadith.
Interesting.
Because the imam would answer those questions, right? Imam would tell you how to pray, how to fast. You'd ask the imam, new issue comes up. You'd ask the imam, oh, you know, where can we recite the prayer in a different language? Or if we're on a journey, when should we pray? You can ask all that to the imam if you're Shia. If you are what I would call proto-Sunni, you need another solution. So one of the solutions was, well, what did the prophet say? So then you need to then find out, well, what did he say? So you start asking everybody, you know, what did he say? Somebody will say, well, you know, my teacher or my father told me that the prophet said X. So that's a hadith.
Right.
Right. So now the emerging Sunni community, what will become the Sunni community, they say that, you know what? We have the Quran. And if we can just recover what Muhammad said, that's good enough. We'll get our answers. So in the 800s, these Sunni scholars or proto-Sunni scholars, they start writing down these hadith. Scholars go around, like Bukhari and Muslim, they go around Ahmed ibn Hanbal, they travel around, they ask people, what have you heard about what the messenger said? Mm-hmm. And they were, for their standards, they were rigorous.
Okay. So
they needed a chain of narrators back to the prophet. Right. So if they just went to somebody and somebody said, you know, the prophet said, you know, pray four times a day, they would ask, well, how do you know he said this? And the person would have to say, well, I heard from my father. He heard from this guy. He heard from this companion who heard the prophet. Right. So this is called an isnad. So the Sunni scholars went around. They heard these hadiths and some of them started writing them down into collections in the 800s. There were many hadith collections. Okay. But over time, the Sunnis decided through various reasons that there were six collections that they're going to trust.
Okay.
And that's known as like the six books of the Sunni hadith corpus, right? So Bukhari and Muslim are like the top two, but then there are others. There's Tirmidhi, Abu Dawood, Nasai, and stuff like this. So they have like six in total, okay? But Bukhari and Muslim are the top two. But that took a while for them to decide. because everybody was making a Hadith corpus. There are many Hadith corpuses that predate these that are not part of the six that you could still technically use. So while the Sunnis are doing this, the Shia are following Imams.
Right.
The Shia don't have a Hadith corpus, and they don't follow the Sunni Hadith corpus when it's being written down. And the 12er Shia, they will write down Hadith and put it together in a Hadith book only after the Imam disappears.
So let me ask you this question then. So during this time period, you know, when the is it Shia, right?
Shia is a noun. Like refers to the group, and okay. Shi'i is an adjective.
Okay.
But you can just say Shia. It's fine.
Yeah. So within the Shia tradition at this point, were they recording what the Imams were saying, or was it kind of just done as an oral practice and you kind of maintained that practice? Because like then would you have different practices between, say, different Imams, you know, over time, or was it consistently the same?
We don't have a lot of evidence. So the Shia Hadith records are written in the late 800s and the 900s.
Okay. Right?
And the Imams are living in, at least from in their lineage, the Imams are present in the 700s and the 800s.
Right.
So there's a gap, right? There's sort of a time gap here. It's not as big as the Sunni time gap,
sure,
in terms of the written and when the Prophet lived, but there is a gap. So we have different reports. Like there are reports that some of the Shia did have notebooks.
Okay.
But we don't have access to those notebooks.
Right.
Right? So they could have existed and maybe they did, right? So Imam Jafar is reportedly telling his followers, you know, write stuff down, your kids are gonna need this. But those have not survived, right? It seems that the Shia practice of collecting the sayings of the Imams, or at least writing it down, happened earlier and it was more rigorous.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be that the Shia records are a bit better. But definitely, even on the side of Shia Hadith, there are anachronisms, right?
Sure.
So one problem with all the Hadith literature is there are clear statements that are attributed to the Prophet that he clearly could not have said, you know,
right,
that were forged, that reflect a later theological idea or a later political idea. And this is a problem in modern critical Hadith scholarship.
Sure.
You know, you have these anachronisms in the Hadith literature. And sometimes people, you know, often you can make up a fake chain that looks very connected.
Yeah.
You know, a great example I can give you. So in the Sunni Hadith corpus,
right,
there is a widely transmitted Hadith in somewhat different versions, which claims where Aisha, the wife of the Prophet, claims that he got engaged to her when she was six.
Right.
And then they got married when she was nine.
Right.
And there are many versions and there are many chains for this Hadith in the Sunni books. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's massively transmitted. And if you relied on the Sunni traditional methodology, you would accept this Hadith as authentic. And many do. However, you know, we've had many academics using modern critical methods study the Hadith of the Prophet marrying Aisha, critically checking it against other sources, checking whether these chains check out. And many modern scholars have concluded that this is not historical.
Right.
That this Hadith, that Aisha either never said this, or if she did say this, she just didn't get her age right. Because the Hadith contradicts what is also reported about Aisha and her age and when she died. Their latest study is by a scholar named Dr. Joshua Little, a PhD dissertation at Oxford University. And his conclusion is that this Hadith, although on the face of it, it presents itself as coming from Aisha herself, a first-person testimony, it's actually not that. And it was made up by one of Aisha's, like, great, great, great nephews.
Right.
It was made up in the late 700s in Iraq as a way of praising Aisha. Because, you know, Aisha, her memory was competing with the memory of Imam Ali.
Sure.
on who was closer to the prophet. And it was an established fact that the prophet was the foster father of Imam Ali. Imam Ali was in the prophet's house when he was a boy. He was raised by him. So the likely explanation is that the Aisha marrying the prophet at six, right? Or rather being engaged at six and married at nine, this was fabricated to offer a counter narrative, to present Aisha as closer to the prophet. Understood.
No, I mean, it's interesting because these are the same problems I find, like, whether you do study of gospels, right? Whether you look at the, you know, what the codified gospels become versus the numerous Gnostic gospels or apocrypha sitting out there. And then there's also within the, you know, the Hindu tradition, you end up having, like, the various Puranas and their various chains of lineage. Oh, this person told me, this person told me, this person told me. It's very similar problems of trying to authenticate whether these things are actual, real, like, so I find it, you know, these are human issues of trying to determine how do we get back to the source and understand what we should be doing and how it should be done. And I find, so in the Shia context, so with the practices, because the imams from the time of the seventh century onwards were kind of guiding the community, would those practices be different from the Sunni practices that end up being case? Like, for example, is Ramadan time period different for Sunnis versus Shiites? And is there like the method of even worship, is it different?
Yeah, so already in the 700s, and there's academic research by critical historians to substantiate this. So in the 700s, certain Shia practices related to prayer, for example, related to the ritual washing before you pray, and related to some other issues, certain Shia practices are already distinct from the non-Shia. Okay. Let me give you an example, okay, that scholars have cited. And this, of course, accords with whatever we know about community formation. So communities tend, when their communities are differentiated from one another, they differ on belief, but you can't, like, read people's minds to know what they believe.
Right.
So what really makes communities different are rituals.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's how it works. This is also the case, I mean, before I talk about the Shia and non-Shia, in the lifetime of Prophet Muhammad, when the community of Prophet Muhammad first goes to Medina, where there are many Jewish tribes,
mm-hmm.
There is evidence to suggest that the times of prayer that Muhammad's community performed, when they prayed, where they prayed, and the days they fasted, was very similar to the Jewish tribes in Medina.
Okay? Interesting.
Yeah. For example, there's evidence that they would have prayed three times a day in Medina. That's how many times the Jews pray,
mm-hmm.
right? We know that when Muhammad's community, this is in the 620s, when they first come to Medina, they face Jerusalem when they pray. Like, they turn in the direction of Jerusalem, which is what the Jews did.
Right.
However, political relations between Muhammad's community and certain Jewish tribes in the next few years broke down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So about two or three Jewish tribes committed treason, for example. So what we find that the Quran, in the verses that are revealed in this era, the Quran modifies these practices. So the Quran introduces a new type of fasting that the followers of Muhammad will do in the month of Ramadan.
Mm-hmm.
That order to fast in Ramadan comes in a few years, maybe two or three years after the migration to Medina. In Mecca, they didn't have a Ramadan fast. Nobody was doing that, right?
Right.
Why did that fast get introduced when it did? Well, it replaced an earlier fast that Muhammad's community did with the Jews on the Jewish Day of Atonement. Similarly, when those fasting changes came around the same time, Muhammad's community, according to the Quran, was told, stop praying in the direction of Jerusalem. You're now going to face Mecca when you pray. Right? And there were the Quranic verses about that. Now, many people were like, what is this?
Right.
In Muhammad's own community, people are like, why you're changing this? Right? It's a shock. But the change was argued for and justified. And now we can ask, and theologically, you know, you can speculate what's going on, right? Well, it's God's will. God wanted this way. But let's look at this holistically. To me, it's very obvious that ritual changes while Muhammad is alive are they're purposed to create community,
right?
To create an identity for this new Muslim or believer group that is differentiated from their Jewish neighbors.
Interesting.
That process of identity construction through ritual distinctiveness, I would argue that continued after the Prophet died.
That makes sense.
So now let's go to that case. So one difference among others, okay? So when Muslims begin reciting the Quran in daily prayer, the first verse of every chapter of the Quran is the Basmalah, Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Right.
Now, here's the difference. Do you say that aloud or should you say it silently? At that time and continues till today, the majority Sunni practice, is to say the Bismillahirrahmanirrahim silently. Okay, in prayer.
Okay.
The Shia from the 700s were guided by the Imam to say it aloud.
Interesting. Okay.
So already, if you're just attending mosques at this time, you could sort of tell who is Shia and who is non-Shia.
By who
just
vocalizes.
Based on this stuff.
Yeah.
So you have stuff like this. And there's other, there are other examples, but I don't want to belabor the point. But it seems like the imams of the Shia are giving guidance, especially on practice, in a very responsive way.
True.
Often they would tell their community, if you don't know what you should do, look at what the Sunnis are doing and just do the opposite.
Sure. Sure. One second, Khalil. I'm just going to pause. Okay, so we have the differences in practice in the early stage. Now, would there be differences in practice between the general Shia and the Ismailis? Or is there similarity here in practice too?
No. So there are differences between the Ismailis and the Twelver Shia in practice. So the reason is this. The Twelver Shia followed, 11 visible imams, the last of whom died in 874. Since 874, the Twelver Shia have not had direct access to a guiding imam.
Right.
So what the Twelver Shia did is they compiled, starting in around the 900s, they compiled the hadith, the sayings of their first 11 imams, and they based their practice on what the first 11 imams of their lineage told them to do. Right. So
right.
That's the type of practice that's rooted in guidance given in the 8th and 9th century. And although they differ from the Sunnis on these fine points, like I told you, from a very superficial perspective, their practices look like Sunni practices, right?
Okay.
The prayer formally looks very similar. The Ismailis, on the other hand, right, have had access to a lineage of imams who are giving continuous guidance across time and across space.
Got it.
And because Ismaili communities developed over time and space in very distinct cultures and distinct regions, the Ismaili imams allowed a lot of flexibility for religious practice. So at certain times, the Ismailis in Central Asia would be practicing in a certain way. They would just develop distinct traditions, right? And the Ismailis in South Asia would develop distinct traditions. And the imams would be aware of these, and they would authorize this ritual diversity that you have.
Was there always one imam at a time, or is there multiple imams at a time?
No, there's only one imam at a time.
Okay.
So the imam, after his father has died, his predecessor has died, he's the imam. And when he dies, the successor will take over.
Okay.
So there's one imam at the top, but in most periods, the imam had a network, a hierarchy of deputies, teachers who would go out on the field to educate particular communities on how they should be acting according to the imam's guidance. Because, imam geographically lived in one place.
Right.
But he had a network of people out and about. We called them dais. And they're actually going around with the imam's guidance and messages
And how do they have their own system of appointment? Like, you know, after the imam goes away, do these dais still
go? Yeah, so the imam would appoint the dais.
Yeah.
Most of the time. And the dais would regularly get recalled to the imam's headquarters, wherever he was living, for reappointments. Sometimes the imam would say, okay, this family... he would pick a certain family, and the dais may come from them from a few generations. But in modern times, what's happened is this dai network that the Nizari Ismailis have, that is gone now, because using modern communication, the Ismaili imams of the 20th and 21st century, they are now in direct contact with almost all Ismaili communities.
Makes sense.
And now. The imam visits a place, he gives guidance, it's written down on the spot, it's published to the various communities. The imam sends letters regularly to all these communities. So there's about 20 Ismaili councils, okay? These are governing bodies, 20 Ismaili councils across the world that are directly appointed by the imam and in touch with the imam. And these day-to-day matters of community governance and administration is looked after by these councils,
right?
You know, like getting a prayer space and making sure there are people to run it. It's the councils that look after that, and then the imam regularly gives guidance, either orally or written form. So all religious practices that Ismailis do today are directly authorized by the present imam. And certain practices are uniform. All Ismailis have the same prayer, right? Regardless of where you live, there's an Arabic prayer that's done three times a day called the dua. But in addition to that, the imam has allowed and has authorized distinct forms of religious expression within different communities. So South Asian Ismailis will recite devotional hymns called ginans. Persian Ismailis and Central Asian Ismailis will recite devotional hymns in Persian language called qasidas. Syrian Ismailis will recite devotional stuff in Arabic, right? So the imam has allowed ritual diversity, and he's allowed cultural diversity while mandating some practices be the same. And this allows different Ismaili communities to do meaning making in their own way, but remain united, ritually speaking.
Well, that's fascinating. I mean, that's really, really interesting system. So, the general Shias at this point, their practices are kind of fixed, right? In terms of from the last imam, or no?
I would say that the template of their practices are fixed, but the details. For the 12er Shia, the details of practice,
right,
that is interpreted by a class of scholars called Ayatollahs, right, or Marjas. So today's 12er Shias, when it comes to day-to-day religious matters, like all the nitty-gritty, they can't go to the imam, he's not accessible. So they have developed in their community a scholarly class of people called Ayatollahs. And every 12er Shia who believes in the Ayatollah system, they have to pick one who's living.
Sure.
And they imitate that person's understanding of Islamic practice.
Got it. So also another practice point, do the Shias also do the Hajj, or are they, is that something they don't have to do as part of their
tradition? So the 12er Shia and the Sunnis.
Yeah.
They follow the same template of mandatory practices, what is otherwise known as the five pillars of Islam, you know, quote unquote. So 12ers and Sunnis do those. So they pray five times a day.
Right.
They fast from food and drink in Ramadan. They go to Mecca for pilgrimage.
Okay.
They give zakah, although the zakah actually differs between Sunnis and Shias.
Sure.
But they give zakah. So those types of pillars, apart from certain differences, the 12ers and the Sunnis do it in like more or less the same way.
Okay.
The Ismaili Shia, however, have a different set of ritual practices. The spiritual ideas behind these pillars, the Ismailis believe in. But okay. How the Ismailis actually perform these things differs because the Imams have given updated guidance. So I'll give you an example, right? The Sunnis and the Twelvers pray five times a day, and their prayer is, it involves standing, bowing, and prostration, and mm-hmm. it's like this fixed ritual prayer. The Ismaili prayer is also in Arabic, and it quotes Quranic verses, but it's done sitting down.
Okay.
And it has prostrations, but there's no standing or bowing. So it's a different form of prayer.
Okay. Right?
The pilgrimage that Twelvers and Sunnis do, the mandatory pilgrimage, is to Mecca, right?
Right.
Now, Twelvers also believe that, some say you have to, some say you should, that you do also pilgrimage to the shrine of the Imams.
Okay.
Right? The tombs of the Imams. So there's a Shia idea that you should actually make a pilgrimage to see the Imam.
Mm-hmm.
For the Ismailis, that concept of pilgrimage is practiced where when the Aga Khan, the present Imam, gives an audience, you make a pilgrimage to go see him.
I see that. Okay.
And for Ismailis, that form of pilgrimage to see the Imam of the time, that takes priority over going to Mecca. Because in the Ismaili understanding, the pilgrimage to Mecca, when it was first mandated by the Prophet, and when it happened in like the first, 100 years, from an Ismaili perspective, the real purpose of that pilgrimage to Mecca was to see the Prophet.
Right.
And to see the descendants of the Prophet, who would, in the early period, the Imams would go on pilgrimage and they would meet their Shia there. Right. The pilgrimage was a site for the Imam and the Shia to meet.
Okay.
And the Imam to guide them. So for Ismailis, the real spirit of the pilgrimage is to meet the divinely guided person of the time and give homage to him and receive guidance from him. Like, that's the spirit of pilgrimage.
Right.
So in modern times, for Ismailis, the priority is to go see the Imam.
Right.
In person and hear him and receive his blessings. And that fulfills all the spiritual purpose of going to Mecca.
That's very interesting. It's fascinating to me. Because I don't think people know enough about this diversity internally within Islamic traditions. And I know we're getting close to your time now. So what I want to do is, kind of just close up this session and maybe have you back on in whenever you're free next to talk more about the theology and philosophy and the differences maybe between these various traditions on how they think about God and the world and salvation, things like that. Because, I mean, this is very important to me, the practice, the history, because I think it grounds how we approach everything else. But, I do appreciate that. So Dr. Andani, do you have like any last comments about these topics we talked about today before we close out?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, so we talked a lot about practice, so I'll just give a quick 1 minute like primer on, because I think a lot of people will hear like, oh, what do you mean, how can the Imams change practices and
right
so on. So the principle is this: Muslims believe that God throughout history, through the mediation of his prophets, has mandated certain rules of behavior and worship. However, these rules that God has mandated at different times and different places, including the Quran, these rules are based on higher wisdoms. And what's essential about the rules of practice are the wisdoms behind the practice. In the Ismaili perspective, the role of the Imam is to renew and refresh and update the rules of behavior and practice so that throughout changing times, places, and circumstances, the practices of the community will always reflect the eternal, unchanging wisdoms that God has mandated. So rulings can change, practices can change, but the inner wisdom, the goals of those practices, that does not change.
Right.
But because human circumstances are in flux, the rules themselves cannot be static, because rules in one period of time can serve certain wisdoms, but then in a drastically altered world, those same rules may not lead to those wisdoms. So the rules have to be refashioned by someone who knows what those wisdoms are. And for the Ismailis, that person is the Imam. And that's why Ismaili practice has changed throughout time and space.
And I'll just put a corollary here. I think it's interesting here because that's a similar idea within the Dharmashastra traditions about the nature of how rules are based on desha, kala, titi, which is time, place, and situation. And on those three factors, what we call shishtas are people that know the law, that understand like and have good practice themselves, can give you guidance on how to change the laws to fit the time, place, and situation so that, you know, people still have a fruitful life, but they're not bound by these fixed rules that are meant for different time and communities. So, you know, I think there's a lot of corollaries here. But Dr. Andani, I know your time's up. I really appreciate your time and, you know, your conversation here to bring to light so many of these issues and ideas. So, I'd love to have you back on the show very, very soon. I know you got a busy schedule with kids and work, but we'll make it happen. So thank you again for joining us.
No, thank you. Thank you very much. And yeah, next time we'll do a deep dive into metaphysics and theology and all that juicy stuff, which I know you're into. So
yeah, absolutely. So thank you everyone for listening and we'll talk to you soon. पावन मुनि जन यमुना तीरे पावन मुनि जन यमुना तीरे गायती वनमाली गायती वनमाली गायति वनमाली।